In 2016, Phoebe Waller-Bridge presented the world with Fleabag, a series co-produced for Amazon and British TV. She not only writes the show, but she stars in it too. She plays a young woman, only referred to as Fleabag, who is bruised by external and internal struggles. And in 2019, the show came back for its second and, we're told, final season.
Fleabag is funny and sad and sexy, touching on grief, family, and in the second season, faith. Co-stars include Sean Clifford as Fleabag's sister, Oscar winner Olivia Colman as her godmother and pending stepmother, and Andrew Scott as the priest she meets in season two. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, it's always a pleasure to have with us, Weekend Edition books editor Barry Hardiman. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
Oh, it's Fleabag.
Woo!
Now, we talked about Fleabag a little bit in the first season. We don't always return to shows in the second season, but this was one where, I don't know what your Twitter experience was, but as soon as this dropped, people started convincing me to try to get to the second season, to the point where I felt a little bullied. Did you have that experience in your various timelines?
Well, actually, I resisted the second season for a while only because, and you can check the tape, I said that Fleabag season one was the best thing on television in 2016. And I also said on that same Pop Culture Happy Hour that I do not want a season two because that first season nailed the dismount in a way that I have not experienced in a hugely satisfying way. So
Yeah. When
I went into it, I went in with my arms crossed and kind of grumpy and became a self-fulfilling prophecy. The first time through, I wasn't digging it largely because, as you say, it is a lot about grappling with issues of faith, and that's basically sports to me in a negative sense. It's just, you know, I've said this before, I'll say it again. It's like reading an owner's manual to a car I don't own.
It's
Why?
Not something that's super meaningful to you.
It doesn't resonate with
yeah.
me. But then I got the assignment to review it for Weekend Edition Sunday. I figured I owed it another look, and that time I could see it a lot more clearly. I was not distracted by all the faith stuff, which, again, is not my jam. It's doing something with a much higher degree of difficulty than season one is doing because it doesn't have that built-in narrative structure of a central mystery and a huge revelation.
Right.
It is trying to tackle something that Crazy Ex-Girlfriend tried to tackle, and it successfully in its latter seasons, of someone trying to get better. And that comes with a different kind of payoff. The process of her getting better is fits and starts. It's a lot smaller. It's a lot more delicate, I thought, than season one. And I thought it was hugely satisfying.
Yeah. Barry, how did you come down on season two?
The first season, I felt very much like Glenn. I loved it so much. I found myself truly sobbing through the last episode. And when I really like something like that, I'm just not good enough to not want more. So I was like, give it to me all over again, even if it's the same thing. So I entered, and that first episode is a masterpiece of the second season. And so yes. after that,
That's the dinner party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The dinner, yeah. And it's also the jumpsuit. So,
yeah.
I mean, everything about it was like, woo, here you go.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge as Fleabag. And by the way, the people in the show don't call her Fleabag,
right.
If that's confusing to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what the show materials refer to her as.
Mm-hmm.
She has no name in the show. Nobody gives her a name. And neither does the priest that she has this kind of friendship relationship with in mm-hmm. season two also does not have a name, which is why people on Twitter call him Hot Priest. But she wears a jumpsuit in the first episode of the second season that became a social media sensation, everyone trying to order it. And it isn't outrageously expensive.
No. And it can still be ordered right now.
And yeah. It can still be ordered. So
it has been ordered in my house.
It became a sensation.
It is hanging in mine.
But Barry, you were talking about the first season, the masterpiece, the jumpsuit.
Yes. After that, I thought, oh, we're doing something different here.
Yeah.
Especially, it was really nice to start with her... I thought her first sort of foray into trying to be healthy in this
mm-hmm.
way that doesn't quite work, but is maybe the way a lot of people try to get healthy, which is fits and starts. So I was in from the get-go and again found myself really incredibly moved by the last episode. And I had the opposite experience that Glenn did, which is that I loved it, I devoured it upon a first go. And on a second watch, I felt differently about the priest the second time around.
Yes.
Which we'll get to.
Stephen, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I ate it all up. Loved the first season, came in once we were going to do this show to finally just mainline the second season, and really loved it too. I had some issues with the power dynamics between her and the priest. I think it's probably the reaction, Barry, that you had on the second mm-hmm. viewing I had on the first. But otherwise, I really just devoured it. And lots of shows are about learning and loving and growing. This show ultimately kind of is a little bit, but in this very, very tentative way. And, you know, faith is in it. Glenn, you talked about faith being a big concept around the second season, but really, as much as anything, it's about interconnectedness and the value of interconnectedness and just the importance of breaking away from kind of this constant interior monologue that is going on in her life and forcing her to actually be,
live it,
to use a couples therapy term, present mm-hmm. in the conversations that she has. And there's an amazing scene in the third episode that you're hearing people kind of allude to or just directly talk about that really is one of the most important scenes of television I've seen in a long time, where she is suddenly kind of confronted with the way that she looks at the world and kind of compelled to reassess. And the show pivots from that point in a really interesting and really subtle way, leading to an ending. Man, Glenn, you talked about how the first season ended perfectly and stuck the dismount. This thing, to me, just sticks the dismount absolutely perfectly. I don't need more of the show. And I've seen, you said that about season one. I'm saying it right here.
Feel that way about this one.
Yeah, I actually feel that about this show. And I think it's fine for shows to end.
And I also want to say, it's not just a story ending. I think there's a very, very good piece by Catherine Van Arendonk
yes.
in Vulture about the fact that the ending is not just the ending of a story. The ending is affirmatively about ending the story. It is about ending the show. And it's about, I don't feel too worried about the spoiler aspects of this at this point, because it's been around for a few weeks. But, and this is a filmmaking thing, which it's also nice to have a show like this with such interesting filmmaking, I think.
Yeah.
But one of the show's little, I don't want to say gimmicks, it's whatever the positive version of gimmicks
flourishes.
Is that she looks at the camera quite a bit, as they would say, breaks the fourth wall, looks at the camera, speaks to the audience. And that's always been a way for her to kind of express what's going on in her mind inwardly. But they've also made it pretty clear that it's a way for her to maintain a certain distance mm-hmm. from whatever is going on in her life. And if you've never known somebody who is into commenting upon all the things that are happening to them in a way that gives them a certain amount of distance, mm-hmm. then hello, we've never met. No, that is a really common habit. And she does that, I think, at the beginning. And that's part of what that fourth wall stuff is, which is why it's so important that at some point she realizes that the priest, when she is engaging in these fourth wall breaks, nobody else in her life has ever been conscious of her doing this. It's just everyone else just goes on with whatever they're doing. That he's aware that something is happening in these moments that mm-hmm. she turns toward the camera, that she's not there. Mm-hmm. She's left somehow. That is such an important development in the second season.
And it's not just the hot priest. It's also, the therapist who's, it's Fiona Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
It's Fiona Shaw,
of course,
right?
It is.
Fiona Shaw, who is just incredible in this, as she is in Killing Eve and All Things, who also, she's aware that the audience is part of Fleabag's problem.
Yeah.
I thought it was so fascinating because this is the kind of thing that could get really annoying, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is just supposed to be a funny tool where she gets to wink at you and say, oh, I'm not going to throw up, and all the funny little asides. It could get really annoying to have somebody call it out. You know what I mean?
Right.
And instead, the audience is brought along as, you know, part of her therapy in this way
right.
that is just, which is kind of gorgeous.
And there are people who need their lives to be observed
mm-hmm.
in order for them to feel real. That is a thing that I think happens in real people's
yes,
lives.
Absolutely.
A need to be observed and commented upon in order to feel like you really exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a little bit of that in what she's going over with the therapist at that point.
Yeah. And we talked about all those hot priest memes. That kind of bugged me because, yeah, okay, he's hot. But he's also Andrew Scott, who has been
right.
around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just hot priest, people.
No, he's Moriarty.
Watch Sherlock. Watch this really good movie, little movie he's in called Handsome Devil. He's mm-hmm. great. He's always great. But this thing about the power dynamic didn't resonate for me, but I happened to be sitting on the couch with somebody who was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the distinct sense that this thing was landing on him.
Yeah.
Not just the hotness of the priest, but the whole the whole issues of the church
right.
are resonating with him in a way they just weren't.
Because he's not her priest, because right. she's not really religious.
She's in fact an atheist.
He's her parents' priest. So she's an atheist, but it is true. I think the trick to this for me is he is not just a warm and cuddly object of her interest right. and mm-hmm. lust. And when, like Glenn says, the problem with making him gifts of hot priest, not that I don't agree with that because he is very appealing in this, is that I think if you looked inside his mind, it's just as dark as Fleabag's.
Right.
That's,
right.
It's just you're not in there. And right. I think the trick is to see she is doing things sometimes that are very unkind to people and not really fair to people, but you still understand where it's coming from for her. And I think with him, he should not be engaging in this
right.
kind of relationship with her. There's also an element of her refusing to hear no from him mm-hmm. when he does attempt to tell her no in a kind but firm way that she rejects. Mm-hmm. And that is on her.
And on my in my first watch, that was how I felt. On my first watch, I was like, oh, that's Fleabag being Fleabag. And my second watch,
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think it's both.
The trick,
I think he is in some ways being very unfair to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she is in some ways being very unfair to him.
Well, and part of what makes, to me, season two so much richer than season one, and I love season one, is season two spends a lot more time digging into the psyches of the other characters
yes.
on
exactly.
this show.
The sister,
and so
yeah.
you mentioned Hot Priest and what's going on in his head. And I agree. I think this Andrew Scott performance is absolutely magnificent.
He's also in one of the new Black Mirror episodes
yes.
that's coming out this week.
He's magnificent and weird and has this energy that he carries through all of his roles that
right.
that really, really works
Spiky
here.
The choices he's making here are a lot smaller than the choices he makes as Moriarty.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, let's just
yes.
put it that way.
Yes.
But that
yes.
is
but
a,
you
but,
can still see a cup. You can see the echo.
But I want to call out a few other performances
yes.
on this, I think, pretty uniformly mm-hmm. wonderfully acted show.
Mm-hmm.
Brett Gelman as this squirrely,
the most loathsome piece of human garbage on television, which is saying something.
And
who knows it?
And who knows it? And they give him...
Who plays Fleabag's...
Fleabag's sister's husband.
Yeah.
Awful. But you get a look into his psyche and his experiences and his perspective. It is a more empathetic season.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guest performance in the wonderful episode 3.
Yeah, episode
I think
three.
Episode 3, as great as the ending of this episode is, episode 3 is perfect
mm-hmm.
to me. There is an extended sequence involving Kristen Scott Thomas.
Oh my God.
Who, wow, as soon as she pops on screen, I'm like, oh, I missed Kristen Scott
right,
Thomas.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I want to be at a bar with her.
Yeah,
yeah.
And she just comes in and gives this wonderful performance. Olivia Colman
yeah.
as Fleabag's father's new partner. She brings in such a weird energy and is such a
psychopath.
Well, such a deep,
yeah.
so deeply passive aggressive.
Yes.
There's and so, with
it's
so much.
It's beyond British.
It's
so deeply
yeah.
passive aggressive. Yeah.
So like you can sense. I mean, Olivia Colman just won the Oscar for Best Actress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have powerhouse talent just coursing through this show. It's not just about her anymore. And I think the only shame of the show ending. They don't need to make more episodes, but the only shame of the show ending is that as they fan out and discover how much they have to work with these other characters,
that we didn't get more.
I will miss yeah. not having more of them.
And I think Sean Clifford, too, playing Fleabag's sister, Claire. I think that character in the first season was a little bit more flat.
Mm-hmm.
And in this season is much more kind of developed in this great way where that relationship is complicated. There's such a great, like, I don't think I've ever seen such a good and true scene about getting a bad haircut in life as happens to Claire. And there is a lot of stuff about her marriage and her
mm-hmm.
situation, and it doesn't feel like she's just there to be in conversations with Fleabag as much. So the first season is kind of directly post-trauma, right?
It's about grief and guilt.
Mm-hmm. It's grief, guilt. It's trying to get out of that immediate sense of trauma. The second season is sort of, okay,
I
have found some way to equalize myself to where I was before
mm-hmm.
a little bit after this trauma. What does a healthy version of me look like? Because very often a trauma will uncover something that already was present in your life.
Yeah.
It's not just the healing from the trauma. It's kind of like, oh, then I learned all these things about myself and about how this traumatic event came to happen to me. And now I got to go figure out, what does an affirmatively healthy life look like for me? There's such a wonderful conversation with her father, who can be a kind of a soft-spoken character, mm-hmm. who you often feel is a little bit swallowed up by the Olivia Colman
yes.
character. He has a discussion with her at the end about why he thinks she feels everything so deeply. And it's such a wonderfully parental, mm-hmm. I think, reflection. And when you see that, you kind of think, oh, no, he's right mm-hmm. about her. Mm-hmm. And it's so insightful about her.
He does know her. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so generous in that way.
Yeah.
In that monologue that Kristen Scott Thomas has, you can just feel the actress saying, thank you for this. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this.
And can I just name the fact that that is, I think, a barrier broken on television, because that's a monologue about menopause.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is something that happens to half the population that we never talk about. Mm-hmm. And it's not about hot flashes. It's about how great it is.
This show is not a heavy lift.
Right.
You know, each season is 6 episodes long. Mm-hmm. They are, once the BBC's commercials are out of them, they're between, 22 and 28 minutes long each.
Yeah.
Each season you basically watch in roughly the length of a movie.
Yeah.
This is extremely bingeable and enjoyable.
I watched the whole thing, both seasons together in one day.
I did too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the second season of Fleabag, along with the first, is streaming on Prime Video and Amazon. They're pretty short. Give it a whirl. And tell us what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. With a franchised network of highly trained agents and advanced marketing tools, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services network members aim to provide something more than just real estate. They think beyond the next transaction and build relationships based on your long-term goals to ensure you'll get all the value that home brings, year after year, home after home. All that more they do, that's home services. Start your home search at BerkshireHathawayHS.com. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Netflix limited series Tales of the City. Based on the beloved novels by Armistead Maupin, this new chapter revolves around the vibrant characters and tales of Barbary Lane in modern-day San Francisco. Written by an entirely queer writer's room and starring Emmy winner Laura Linney and Ellen Page, this limited series centers around chosen family who believe home is a feeling. Tales of the City, streaming now, only on Netflix.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Last night, as of this taping, I got to see a concert by an old favorite, an artist I've seen live probably 30 times, Glenn Hansard.
didn't take me.
You were moving.
That's true.
Of the Frames, of the Swell Season, and as a solo artist. Among those different configurations, seen him live dozens and dozens of times. And the show was electric and wonderful. If you get a chance to see this guy live, he is absolutely incredible. Played for 2.5 hours. I then, when driving into work this morning, dusted off, I know, Linda, this is a favorite of yours, an album by The Frames called Setlist, which is one of the best live albums by any artist you will ever hear. The album's about 15 years old. It's a Frames album in front of an extremely adoring Irish crowd as Glenn Hansard, star of the movie Once, plays these big, bombastic, beautiful songs, but also then just gives these little monologues between songs that are so warm and so funny and so odd. It is an enormously cathartic experience listening to it after having put it aside for years and years. Just as powerful, just as warm, just as big-hearted as it's ever been. If you know Glenn Hansard from Once, and you never really went back into his Frames catalog, there is just such a rich array of what should just be rock classics. I had stepped away from it for a really, really long time, and it's such a joy to rediscover.
Amazing. You know I'm with you on this one, buddy. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
So last week, I was lucky enough to go, as I do every year, to Book Expo America, which is where you meet with publishers and you get to see all the great stuff that's coming up. And there is a lot of great stuff coming up. And what I'm really loving right now are all of these wonderful books about relationships, which actually kind of work really coming out of Fleabag. I'm like, I'm really in this moment for relationships, whether it be with God or your girlfriends or your husband or whatever. Some wonderful books coming up. Patsy by Nicole Dennis Benn, which is this wonderful book about motherhood and immigration, which is wonderful. A sharp, sharp book about an MFA program called Bunny by Mona Awad. I'm looking at you, Glenn. Mm-hmm. I think you would really love this book.
Cool.
It's like a cross between The Secret History and Heathers.
Oh,
wow.
Set at an MFA program.
All right, I'm in.
It's really, really wonderful. So get on it.
Thank you, Barry. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
You know what I hate, Linda Holmes? Mosquitoes.
Hot take. True, yes.
Serving up a hot take.
Uh-huh,
I'm your server serving your fajitas. Be careful of your fingers. The plate is hot. I do hate them, and I have always hated them. I am now freshly incensed because I am halfway through The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator by Timothy C. Weingard. This thing's a brick. It's 496 pages. It comes out August 6th. He is making what is so far a very persuasive case that the mosquito is the single most powerful force in determining humanity's fate. It has changed the outcome of major wars. And by one estimate that is in all the material promoting this book, he believes they are responsible for the deaths of just about 50% of the people who have ever lived on the planet.
Wow.
Uh-huh. It's hugely impressive. It's a major work, and it's the kind of book that makes me just, as I say, freshly incensed with every page because I hate them so much.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. What is making me happy this week? You don't need me to tell you about Always Be My Maybe, now streaming on Netflix. It is a romantic comedy. It stars Randall Park and Ali Wong. He is of Fresh Off the Boat. She is of stand-up comedy mostly and also comedic acting. It is directed by Ninochka Khan, who developed Fresh Off the Boat and has done a couple of other really cool projects. They are a couple of kids who meet and are besties, and then they have one awkward sexual experience when they are a little bit older, and then they are separated for a long time and go off and get involved with other people, and then they meet up again, and it becomes a romantic comedy. It is funny. It is specific about the fact that they are Asian Americans who grew up in San Francisco, and there's a lot of very loving commentary on what their families are like. His family is Korean American. Hers is Vietnamese American. And they are, you know, there's a lot of really lovely touches. The great James Sato plays his father.
He's so
really
good.
Funny. Oh. He's really funny and so good. And right in the middle, in the place where romantic comedies often sag, you get this fantastic performance from Keanu Reeves. Keanu Reeves playing Keanu Reeves, mm-hmm. a version of himself. Mm-hmm. If you do not remember that Keanu Reeves is Asian American, he is. He has Chinese and Hawaiian heritage. I have never seen a performance as yourself that I have found any funnier than this.
Agree.
If you have mm-hmm. forgotten how funny Keanu mm-hmm. Reeves is as he has done more action and other stuff, you got to watch Always Be My Maybe. Watch it. Find it on Netflix. That is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Barry at B. Hardiman and Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks. And thank you for listening. If you have a second, please do subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
Mitch McConnell has become a champion for conservatives. But back in the day, he once got support from groups like labor unions.
I mark it down as one of the worst things I've ever done in my life.
So you thought about it over the years?
Oh, I still think about it every time I see his face.
Mitch McConnell, a new series from Embedded. Subscribe now.